some of you might have been wondering about the multimedia extravaganza here. But we just decided it was supposed to be sunny and we weren't going to be able to see too much on the screen. So we're going to go old school. Well, I want to thank you for inviting me here once again. And my wife was able to make it again today because school isn't in, so she might not be able to make it too much, so you should see her while you can. And just to put in a plug, I'm not sure about the other guys who come to visit you, but when I come, I try to make the class somehow tied to the sermon. So if you're not involved in another class, I really encourage you to come and be part of that class, because I'm hoping you'll get more out of it. Because first of all, Bob has explained it all during class, but secondly, because I intend to dig a little deeper in the class than we can get to in this talk. So by all means, do plan to come and be part of the class if you can. The readings today were twofold, and I would say that the reading from John is really our key verse today. He came from the Father full of grace and truth. And I want you to keep that in your mind as we go through the other parts. So starting with the reading from Luke, we pick up with Jesus in chapter 6, near to the beginning of his ministry. If you go back and look further back in the book of Luke, beginning in chapter 4, there's the incident where he is in the synagogue, and we looked at that in our class a little bit this morning, and he reads from the scroll of Isaiah, and he says, "This has been fulfilled today in your hearing." There are healings from fever, from demons, and of a leper. And yet, you already see the beginnings of the contention that he is going to have to endure throughout his ministry. In chapter 5, there's the famous story we like to learn as children about the paralytic who is lowered through the roof. But Jesus doesn't just fix his inability to walk. He forgives the man's sins. And he is challenged. Who can forgive sins except God? Well, yes. Only God can forgive sins. So when these people are challenging them, they just missed the point. It is only God that can forgive sins, and he's right here with you right now. And of course, he's been accused of eating with tax collectors and sinners, spending his time with people of bad character. Which leads to chapter 6 in our first reading. Jesus is going to be confronted by difficult people. So for the last little while we've been here, I've been working through this little series, which I call Jesus and ... Today we're going to look at Jesus and difficult people. And in this particular instance, we're going to look at a difficult group of people we call the Pharisees. And he's going to be challenged over a very core Jewish institution, the Sabbath, which is not just locked up in Moses' law, which it is, and it's very important for that reason, but even more fundamental than that, it goes back to creation itself. One Sabbath, while Jesus was going through the grain fields, his disciples plucked some heads of grain, rubbed them in their hands, and ate them. But some of the Pharisees said, "Why are you doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" Jesus answered, "Have you not read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God and took and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat, and gave some to his companions." Then he said to them, "The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." So they were going through the fields. They were picking grain. That's not stealing. Deuteronomy makes it very clear. It says, when you go into the ripe grain fields of your neighbor, you may pluck off the kernels in your hand, but you must not use a sickle on your neighbor's ripe grain. So it's fair to go in and take a handful if you need it. But if you're going to bring in a John Deere and start harvesting, that's something entirely different. Okay? So why are they so upset about this? Why do the Pharisees have this problem with him? They say, you're doing something that's not lawful on the Sabbath. Luke alone of our authors notes that they rub them together. Maybe the Pharisees thought that the act of rubbing this grain together and getting rid of the chaff was actually work, as opposed to just popping them in whole grain, I guess. I don't know. Is that work to have to do that? The disciples were definitely eating, but Deuteronomy says that was their right. The Pharisees are difficult people, are trying to find fault with what these men are doing. We remember the Pharisees, extremely zealous for God, but in a very rigid kind of way. We think of them as very right-facing. So I want you to do a little picture here. Step away from the mic for a minute. If you don't mind, I'll turn my back on you. I can't negotiate looking at you and thinking right and left, getting right. So if you imagine yourself standing in a line of people, and there are people stretching way out to your left and way out to your right, as you turn and you look to your right, you see all these people who are more conservative than you, who are more rigid. Okay, maybe Doug Ford is out at the end somewhere. But all these people look to you to be more conservative. Now turn to your left, where there's a whole line of people, and Justin Trudeau might be out at that end. I don't want this to be political, but clearly those two guys are on opposite ends of this spectrum. And any one of those people who turns to their right sees you as being more conservative and more rigid. And we really like to think of ourselves as being pretty middle of the road and pretty anchored. But to someone else, you look a lot different. So we shouldn't be too quick to judge these Pharisees. They really, truly believed they were doing God's work. And we shouldn't be too quick to judge our neighbors who've never had a personal relationship with Jesus if we think they're too far out on that liberal side. So they say, why are you doing what is not lawful? And the you here is actually plural. They address the disciples, but they make it collective as they talk to Jesus as well. Jesus is implicated with them. It doesn't say that he's actually eating, but he's responsible. He's the leader. And here's where he gets to the core of the matter. Need trumps tradition. Don't you know what happened when David needed this? He took the bread that was not lawful for anyone to eat except for the priests. So this was the holy bread that was put there on the Sabbath, nice and hot and fresh, and the old was taken away. And when the old was taken away, it was given to the priest because it had been consecrated to God. It was only appropriate for the priest to eat it. It had already been given to God, and he had had what he needed of it. It had sat there, the showbread, proclaiming his presence for a week. Now it was given to the priests. But here's this ragamuffin coming in, being chased by Saul, who comes in and says, my men are hungry. And he's given the bread. And no one contested that. And yet, that bread was not supposed to be eaten by anyone except the priest. And Jesus says, just like that situation, my men are holy. We are set aside for God. In Matthew, it actually says the priests desecrated the Sabbath by eating that bread. But God has wanted mercy, not sacrifice. Mercy always triumphs over sacrifice. Jesus says he himself is above the Sabbath because the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. I think there's a whole sermon series there. And Jesus was there when the Sabbath was first established on that sixth day, long before Moses. So our first lesson is about grace. It's about mercy triumphing over sacrifice. In Matthew's version, Jesus says to them, if you had understood what was meant by this passage in Hosea about mercy, not sacrifice, you wouldn't have condemned us because we're innocent. And that's always the way that God deals with people. And that's the way that we ought to deal with people. In dealing with people, mercy first. The Pharisees, they sought to honor God by keeping rules. To them, that was their sacrifice. It is what we give to God that we ensure that these rules are followed. In fact, weren't they striving and contending with this man right now because he was breaking the rules? That's their mindset. And it was their privilege to do that. They really thought they were on the right track. I think there's something that comes into play here, and it's temper. Not that you should have one, but that you should have it. We like to go to the Glass Museum in Corning, and I'm always fascinated by what they show. But they show tempered glass and how it's made. It's put under pressure so that the outside becomes a very, very hard shell that can react to anything. The inside is still extremely soft. But because of that outside, because of that tempering, we can use it for windshields and not have to worry about it breaking and hurting people. So tempered glass has been put under pressure and has this toughened shield, but it's still fragile inside. We're kind of like that. If we have temper, we can be tougher on the outside. We're still pretty soft on the inside. So mercy should be balanced by a knowledge of who you are. That's being tempered. Then, like Jesus, you can bestow grace. Jesus stands alone as Lord and Creator, but we can never forget that we are God's children, and we have a standing and a place in his house. Let's carry on in Luke, in the same chapter, beginning in verse 6. On another Sabbath, here we go again, he entered the synagogue and taught, and there was a man there whose right hand was withered. The scribes and the Pharisees watched him to see whether he would cure on the Sabbath, so they might find an accusation against him. Even though he knew what they were thinking, he said to the man who had the withered hand, "Come and stand here." He got up and stood there. Then Jesus said to them, "I ask you, is it lawful to do good or do harm on the Sabbath, to save life or destroy it?" After looking around at all of them, he said to him, "Stretch out your hand." He did so, and his hand was restored. But they were filled with fury and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. This time, forthrightly, we're told these people were looking for a way to find accusation against Jesus. In our vernacular, they had it out for him. And this time the Pharisees were joined by another group. If you notice there, it says the scribes. Different versions translate this differently, but probably when you see scribe, you think of somebody writing. There was much more to it than that. I think the NIV gets a little closer with teachers of the law, and a translation that I like to use for study says experts in the law. The Pharisees had brought in ringers. That same word is translated lawyers. So these weren't just the guys in the mailroom doing the photocopying. Well, you get the idea. They were willing to use their best guns to catch Jesus, breaking the law. It says they watched, they spied. One of the translations used the word to explain this assiduously, which I had to look up because I didn't know what that meant. And the definition of assiduously is with relentless intent and patience. They were doing everything they could to trap him. And we have to give them some credit. Their tradition allowed that a healing could occur if a life was threatened. If somebody's life was in danger, you could heal. But let's face it, this man had an inconvenience, right? His hand didn't work right. He had a deformed hand. But Jesus knew their hearts. They were just using this man to prove a point. I'm not sure if it's significant, but Luke, the doctor, says that it was his right hand. How many southpaws in the audience? Raise your left hand. Just one. Okay. Most of us, the right hand is the stronger one, isn't it? And it says this man's hand had been withered for many years. So he wasn't able to do the things that he liked to do. He just had one hand, and it wasn't his good hand, probably. But Jesus knew their hearts. And it records that Jesus knew what was in a man. So he asks, and for those of you in the class, here's a question for them. It's a trying question. I imagine him appealing to this large crowd. Which is right? Should I do good? Or should we let these evildoers have their plots? Which is important, to save a life or to destroy it? And he knew that they were out to destroy his own life. Was he saving this man's life? Maybe not, but he was making it new. He was replacing the old and the broken with wholeness. And that was a foretaste of what Jesus wanted to do with their hearts. And their reaction is they were furious. The word implies a complete loss of control. Other translations that I read said mindless fury, or the one that I liked was beside themselves with rage. And I just think of a two-year-old having a tantrum and not able to control themselves at all, because that's how angry they were. Wow, that's really angry. All they can do is try to figure out how they can get rid of Jesus and his influence. So what do we learn in this confrontation? A second lesson, we need to say and do what is right. Truth. Grace and truth came with Jesus. In the face of extreme opposition, Jesus stood fast. In fact, he challenged right back. What do you think is right? He's a very provocative man. I don't think that Jesus had a problem with them adding oral tradition to the law. Not until it obscured the principles that God was trying to lay down. Not until those things they added became more important than the truth they were trying to reveal. And not until it divided people rather than uniting them. So now we get to our theme verse, John 1:14. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Remember the two things that we've looked at so far. Mercy, not sacrifice. That embodies grace. doing and saying what is right. That's truth. And unlike Jesus, we can have problems with that. We don't always know how to demonstrate grace and truth properly. But our Master did, and he looks to us to emulate that. All right, if you have a pen and you want to draw on something that you have, or if you want to email me, I'll give you the really fancy PowerPoint version, but we're going to have the old school version right now. I'm going to start with a line that goes horizontal. And we'll say that this line is the grace line. I'll make it this way. Can everybody see that, I hope? And sorry for my poor writing. I should have gotten someone up here who could actually write. And the second line that we'll call truth. Over here, we'll say withholds. And over here, we'll say projects. And down here, we'll say withholds. Again. And obviously up here, projects. And so we have divided things into four areas. And they're related to grace and to truth. So let's look at this area first. What happens when we withhold grace and project truth? This kind of person or this kind of behavior says, I need to win. It's coercive. It's polarizing. This we're going to label bully. I can get the truth across to you, but I'm going to do it by hammering away on you. Truth without grace. Let's go down here. What about the action where we withhold grace and we withhold truth? If I'm having a confrontation with you and I'm not willing to be truthful, and I'm not willing to give mercy, what am I going to do? Well, I'm going to sweep this under the rug, aren't I? All the time, this is simmering in the background. There might be a ceasefire, but something's going to give. It's like the volcanoes in Hawaii. It's all nice on the surface, but underneath, things are building to an explosion. This one. Someday we're going to retaliate because we haven't really dealt with anything. We haven't been truthful. We haven't been merciful. All right. What happens if we project grace but withhold truth? If we're in that kind of behavior, we're likely to give up on ourselves and what is right for the sake and the appearance of calm. We never really address the conflict. It's, let's be friends, let's be close, but again, we never get to the heart of the matter. This kind of behavior enables. And obviously, this is the quadrant that we want to end up in. This is where we want to be because, like Jesus, it projects grace and it projects truth. This is Jesus' way. It deals with the concern but uses mercy. And in our case, it marks us as his followers. What's the single thing, if you have to say one thing, that marks us as Christians? This is the okay, that's the exceptional multi-extravaganza here, multimedia. We've seen how Jesus dealt with difficult people and with people who had an agenda to harm him. So I have two lessons that I want us to take away. First lesson, know who you are. You are a child of God. You are known by him. You've been loved for all eternity before you even were even growing in your mother's womb. Jesus knew who he was because of his relationship with his Father, and so should you. That means that you can project truth because you have a solid foundation. Number one, know who you are. Number two, know who you are. You're a sinner. You know that you've fallen short. Of yourself, you're exactly what God cannot abide, darkness to his light. But you've been bought with a price. You're a child of grace. That means you know what it is to be forgiven, and you can project grace to others. Did you catch that? Lesson one, know who you are. Lesson two, know who you are. Lesson one, know who you are from above, that you are God's child. Lesson two, know who you are from within. You're a sinner. One of those tempers the other, and we need those two things in equal balance in order to deal with difficult people. And let's face it, we're not just talking about dealing with difficult people. This is the way we should deal with everyone. One practical lesson that we can learn from Jesus: ask questions. In our examples today, he asks questions that delve deep to the principles that we all share. Too often when we deal with a difficult person, we want to fix what we perceive as wrong. Asking questions takes us away from the clump, from the conflict, and what truth the other person sees, and lets them examine themselves and gives us the opportunity to show grace. And as the Bible says in 1 Peter 4, verse 8, love covers a multitude of sins. Know that you are loved by God, and you can project grace and truth and love others. We're going to sing a song. And I think it fits in very well. I believe it's "What a Friend We Have in Jesus." Oh, no, we did that already, didn't we? It is. Oh, okay. Sorry. I'm getting them confused. Yeah. Jesus has already walked that path. He's shown us the way of grace and truth. Now it's up to us to accept on both counts that God loves us and that God has given us mercy.